Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of March. And it's Monday at 9, which means it's all things political. We have much to talk about today, starting, of course, with the economy. And our guest this hour is Chase Martin, a gentleman we found and we've talked with frequently since the Iowa caucuses back in January of last year. He's managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Our phone number for you to join all things political today is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd care to send an email, you can do that this morning. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Chase Martin, hello again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I hope you're doing well, too.
Yeah, doing fine. Thank you. You know, one of the news items that struck me over the weekend was this visual of people establishing a tent city in Sacramento. I don't know if you saw that report, but I thought, oh my gosh, I just haven't seen this before. It was so striking.
I saw it only briefly, but yeah, it's an exciting time to be alive, I guess.
Oh my gosh. A lot of families, and I guess they're adding families every single week. This must be happening in other places in the country.
Yeah, it's striking.
So what do you think? Have we not hit bottom yet? Are we in for even rockier times? And, of course, the second part of the question, is there anything we can do to reverse this trend? Can the president do more?
Well, you know, frankly, from what I've been reading, Kathleen, my first thought is I don't think anybody really quite knows exactly where the bottom is.
Mm.
I think that's probably making it worse than it otherwise would be, unfortunately. You know, it's the uncertainty that really makes the economy worse, you know, than it already is. And when nobody knows how bad it's going to be, it just gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've been watching the stock market with everybody else. And I think a lot of people, you know, it's starting to affect a lot of people. I don't know how bad it's going to get, or what can be done to fix it. And I think the real problem is most American people aren't really sure there can be anything done to fix it, and most people in the United States don't know how bad it's going to get. So I think those two unanswered questions are probably the key to the problem at this point.
Right.
You know, they've become a pretty major cause of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So
Paul Krugman had an interesting column this morning. There are three big questions he writes about economic policy. First, does the administration realize it isn't doing enough? Second, is it prepared to do more? And third, will Congress go along with stronger policies?
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's a pretty popular belief among economists who seem, you know, they seem to believe that this, I guess, what was originally $800 billion or originally $700 billion got it turned into $800 billion with that first stimulus package that President Obama asked Congress for, you know, that most economists who are really serious about this seem to think that they pulled that number mostly out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they picked the number that seemed the largest number that they could get through Congress and the largest number that the American people would let them have for the first stimulus bill. So I think that's a fair question to ask. Because it doesn't seem like most of the economists I've been reading have been, you know, saying that they think that stimulus bill will work. They seem to be saying, well, it's a big number, so maybe it'll do something, but they'll probably need more still. It's interesting.
And need more sooner than we thought, that a second stimulus bill may be just months away?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, that introduces the question, you know, a lot of that first stimulus bill will not have even gone into effect by then. Do we need to come up with a better, faster way of spending that money? Which may or may not even be possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's another criticism economists have been making.
And what about what Congress would be willing to go along with? It wasn't a real difficult fight, but he did need three Republicans to get the first stimulus bill through. You've got Republicans saying this isn't the way to go at all. This is socialism, et cetera, et cetera. Would he face a huge uphill battle to get a lot more in a second stimulus bill?
Yeah, I think it's undeniable that compared to that first stimulus bill, getting a second stimulus bill passed that was anywhere near the magnitude of that first bill will be a much heavier lift politically. It it seems pretty clear that the Republicans who have been opposing the President Obama's economic plans seem to be, you know, growing stronger, not weaker. They seem to be more emboldened than they were 2 or 3 weeks ago to continue opposing those sorts of plans. So it does seem like, you know, once President Obama has 6 or 7 different parts of his policy agenda that he's advocating for all at once, which seems to be the style he's going for with, you know, that big speech he gave and, you know, declaring that health care was a goal this year and all that, he will have less political capital to spend on this particular issue, and it'll probably get a lot harder.
He has been criticized, as you know, Chase, for taking on too many things at once, that maybe we needed to wait for health care until the economy was in better shape. Is that valid criticism, do you think?
You know, if I wanted to pretend that I knew exactly what the solution to our economic troubles were,
right,
maybe I could get a better gig than I've got. but I understand those fears, and that was something that occurred to me when I first heard him. You know, when he first made that speech, it does seem that he's setting a very, very ambitious policy goal. That said, it seems that he subscribes to the historical school of thought that says that, you know, America makes most of its rapid changes in times of crisis, and, you know, he sees this crisis and says, you know, this is our opportunity to get all these things done. And I think on top of that, of course, he legitimately believes, and there's a fair amount of evidence out there to support this, that the health care system, you know, the cost of health care in the United States really is crippling businesses large and small, especially small businesses now and large businesses who have a lot of legacy costs from, you know, previous employees going back 50 years. Those are the two groups of businesses that seem most hurt by the bad healthcare system, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's no surprise then that we have GM going out of business. We have a lot of small businesses having to cut back and just not offer healthcare anymore and all that. You know, there's some thought, at least in the Obama camp, that fixing healthcare is a necessary part of fixing the economy, because without it, our companies in the United States just can't compete with companies in other industrialized countries where the healthcare costs are much lower.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'd like to factor in is his popularity, and it seems to be just sky high. The American public is saying, we support your policies, we think you're A-OK in our book. How does that help him in moving through these incredibly ambitious plans? And I think that there probably are a substantial number of people in this country as well who are saying, we want you to do more. The public is with him.
Absolutely. And I think that's also a big difference from how it was back in the early 90s, when very quickly public opinion shifted against a lot of the Clinton administration's mm-hmm. main goals, particularly health care. It seems that, at least so far, President Obama has kept most voters who supported him on his side and has, you know, really done a good job capturing the mantle of, or capturing the idea of having a mandate, I guess, you know, laying claim to a mandate. And it seems like it's working. The problem is it does not seem clear that the voters who supported him understand all of the details of the policies that the president is advocating for now. You know, and I think that kind of popular support only works to a certain point. If most of the people who support you couldn't really explain what your, you know, TARP program does, what your economic stimulus bill does, and how big your budget is, then, you know, the support's worth something, but maybe it won't last much longer. You know, it depends. I think that kind of support is fickle. And while everybody supports President Obama now, at least they seem to, you know, that doesn't always last. Historically, it always happens in the first term, you know, at the beginning of the first term of a president. And Obama does seem to be enjoying a lot more popularity than a lot of the most recent presidents, but it certainly can wane.
Right. And the job loss situation just has to change, because if you've lost your job and you don't see anything in the horizon, and that seems to be the case at the moment, then you're not going to be supporting anybody. You just need to figure out how to support yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when the economy just doesn't even feel like it's getting better, when that, you know, that one piece of the economy that we always count on in the United States, which is that, you know, it's always going to grow, and it's always going to, you know, even if right now it's tough for me, it will always get, on balance, better for everybody over time. You know, when that one key fact about our economy doesn't seem true anymore, a lot of strange things can start to happen.
Right. He's also today, he's done quite a few executive orders for a short 6 weeks in office. Today, he's going to be changing restrictions on stem cell research, federally funded stem cell research.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's an issue that has been working for Democrats in the Midwest in particular as an election issue, basically since President Bush began that ban on federal money being spent on stem cell research. So that's a long time coming. Mm-hmm. That seems to be an issue that was discovered by the Democrats in the Midwest around 2003 or 2004. And, you know, it seems like they never ran away from that, always thought it was on their side. And finally, after the Democrats have been using this as an election issue for so long, they're in power and they have the chance to reverse President Bush's decision. It seems like on paper, politically, it's a no-brainer. It's popular with a pretty wide margin, a majority of the population. So, you know, it's interesting that he's doing it, but completely expected.
Right. So there will probably be some jobs in stem cell research, but how many of us are qualified to enter the field, right, Chase?
Yeah.
Alas, alas. Let's welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political for this Monday. We're talking with Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent, looking at the economy, of course, because the situation is fairly bleak and continues to get a little bleaker with every day. I like these questions that Krugman asked in today's column, and let me throw them at you. The three big questions about the economic policy. Has the administration realized, do you agree that it's not doing enough? Some of you may think it's doing way too much. Is it prepared to do more? Should there be more that the government can do? And if so, what would that be? And what about the role of the Republicans in the opposition in moving some of these plans forward? Should there be stronger policies, or will there be too much of a fight with Congress to keep anything more from going ahead? Here's our number. We have a couple lines open, so take them right away. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email this morning, you can do that as well, and that address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chase Martin, our guest. He's managing editor of the Iowa Independent, and this is All Things Political for this Monday, the 9th of March. Let's start our calls. Earl from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Earl.
Chase, I had a question about the need for 60 Senate. I recall when the Democrats were in the opposition, they were threatening to filibuster some judicial appointments by Bush, and the Republican leadership said they had a nuclear option that could get rid of the filibuster entirely. Is that nuclear option still available if this need for 60 votes continues?
Chase?
Sure. I think that's a good question, certainly a legitimate one that a lot of the partisan Democrats who watch what's going on in the Senate right now have been asking. It seems like back when the nuclear option was being discussed, that was back in the days of Senator Bill Frist, essentially running the Senate. And it was mostly in the context of Democrats doing their best to stall judicial appointments made by the president. And it did actually become something of a problem where there were a lot of vacancies in the judiciary because the Democrats were not moving confirmations through the Senate very quickly. But it seems that once talk of the nuclear option became serious, a group of bipartisan senators decided it wasn't even really funny to joke about, and worked very hard to forge a compromise and prevent the filibuster from becoming a casualty of any kind of political fight one way or the other. Even though people outside the Senate seem baffled by the idea of, you know, this arbitrary rule setting this number of votes as the requirement, and if you don't have it, then, you know, anybody can use the arcane mechanism of a filibuster to stop something. But it does, it, you know, within the Senate, people seem to agree that it's a protection that they like to have, and that if they were you know, in the minority. Democrats, too, would like to have the filibuster. I think the most likely way that the filibuster becomes unimportant or irrelevant this year is simply by Democrats winning, you know, that extra seat. They win the Senate seat in Minnesota, and 2 years from now, they have a pretty good shot at getting past 60 and never having to worry about a filibuster.
And we're going to get to Minnesota in a moment. It's the next call. Earl, let me throw some of those questions to you. Are you happy with the stimulus package so far? Should the president be doing more? Will Congress go along with him? Should they?
Yes. It's a little difficult to understand the whole stimulus package, but we definitely need something going on. I'm a little more concerned about some of the banking bailouts and like AIG bailouts, but we do need some stimulus, and I would like to that it go to toward the bottom, the average person, rather than the large corporations all the time.
Thanks for the call. What's your sense of the package? Is it pretty? Is it helping people across the board, do you think, or do you think that the people in the bottom of the society are getting shortchanged, Chase?
Well, I think at this point, we haven't seen enough impacts of the stimulus to really know, you know, where within our population most of the money is going to end up. It seems that the tax cut provisions, and even a lot of the construction provision, a lot of the new infrastructure and new construction money that's going to get sent out to the states, to start doing their construction work and all that, it seems like a lot of that probably will go to the usual general contractors who do a lot of projects for states already, and it seems like a lot of that tax cuts, a lot of the tax cut money will go to, you know, fairly wealthy individuals. At the same time, President Obama has promised to roll back the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy Americans who got the tax cut back in the early 2000s. And it does seem that he is committed to the idea of, you know, trying to make the tax system maybe a little bit harder on wealthy Americans, a little bit easier on lower-income Americans. But, you know, I think it's the jury is still out on exactly who will benefit from the stimulus package. It seems like there are plenty of things being given away to all kinds of groups of people, and the question is just, you know, we have to watch and see who actually benefits and which of the programs that we've promised to different groups of people work and benefit those people and which ones don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I don't think we know.
Thanks, Earl, for your call. Scott is calling next from New Glarus. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Yes, I'm wondering if you can tell me what the latest is on that long, drawn-out Senate race in Minnesota.
Chase?
Sure. I can talk about that for a minute. It looks at this point as if the planets are aligning to a place where Al Franken will likely be the winner once everything is all is said and done. And maybe to your listeners, Kathleen, that isn't news because it seems like that's sort of been the story for a couple, maybe 3 weeks now.
Right.
other than that, though, there was the court fight. And let me actually look up on my computer because we have a sister site in Minnesota that's got a lot of information on the recount. As far as I know, speaking with my colleagues up in Minnesota just yesterday, it doesn't sound like there's much except everybody expects that, you know, right now it's just up to one of the parties to concede or to wait out the courts, which will take quite a while.
How long?
Everyone expects.
When you say quite a while.
Well, the folks I spoke to up in Minnesota were thinking, you know, it could be months.
Really?
But there is some discussion that, you know, neither group wants it to last much longer than this, and so, you know, they could informally reach an agreement to seat Franken more likely than Coleman without resolving it in the courts, and, you know, that could happen quicker. But yeah, they're saying that a court battle could last a significant amount of time.
So do you know if you could seat somebody and then have the court, so at least there's some representation, and then if the court decides the other way, you just switch the person.
Right, exactly. And there was discussion back at the beginning of this that would not be unprecedented for the Senate to do that.
Huh.
The Senate itself would have to decide to seat somebody From my understanding, basically the Senate, the U.S. Senate, is the body that presides over the legitimacy of a particular election to the Senate in any given state. So they would have to decide to seat, say, Al Franken. And if the court battle, you know, ended up resolving itself in Norm Coleman's favor, then they could unseat Franken and seat Coleman. There are a couple of problems with this, but I think the biggest one that, you know, they haven't admitted publicly, but I think you could see it at work, was this entire controversy started almost exactly the same time as Senator Roland Burris was trying to get himself seated in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And Harry Reid and the majority Democrats were very concerned with how it would look when they seated two people claiming to be senator who had not actually been, you know, officially declared senators by their states. Trying to seat both of them at the same time would have been a problem. They didn't want to seat Burris at first, so they had to set a standard for who would get seated and who wouldn't that excluded Burris, and in doing so, they just inadvertently also excluded Franken from, you know, by their standards. So I think that's part of the reason why the Democrats haven't tried to move forward any quicker on that. They're trying to avoid any appearance that, you know, they're rigging it or that they're being irresponsible and, you know, judging the results of an election before it's over. So it seems like they're trying to be as cautious as they can to play the PR game right, and in doing so, they're giving up what could otherwise be, you know, an extra vote for another month that they wouldn't otherwise have it.
Right. Thanks, Scott, very much for the call. Our number, we have a couple lines open for all things political, is 800-486-8655. Jim is calling from Iowa. What's the town, Jim?
Elkader.
Elkader, Iowa. Hi, right. Jim.
Hi there. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Martin for the Iowa Independent website. I read it often, and I'm especially grateful for the coverage that the website has given to the situation in Postville, and Linda Waddington's articles are very balanced and helpful. The question
Thank
is
you.
About immigration reform. It's hard to get any politician to speak to it, and I thought that it might improve after the election, that, you know, I understood why they didn't want to take a stand before the election. Do you think that it's going to be on the agenda of the Obama administration?
Sure, I absolutely do think that immigration issues will be on the agenda for the Obama administration. What their policy goals are actually going to look like, I think, is still unclear. Although, you know, I'm sure you do know that President Obama was a supporter of the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Measure, as it was called, a few years back, that President Bush staked a fair amount of credibility on and couldn't get through Congress. So it seems fairly likely that if President Obama is to put forward a plan, it's going to look a fair amount like that. The one thing that I will say, though, is in an economic downturn like this, immigration issues seem to become more potent politically, but it seems to become less of a problem in real life simply because when our economy worsens, fewer people are trying to get here to work in it. And, you know, when there are fewer job openings, even at the lowest wages where the most recent immigrants seem to turn up and work, even those jobs are going away, and people who wanted better jobs are taking those jobs now. So there are fewer jobs for immigrants to take, and that will likely result in, you know, a drop in immigration, or at least a smaller increase in immigration than we've seen in previous years. So while I think that politically that's going to become a more potent issue because when the economy worsens, that's just how it works. It seems like that will likely be, you know, lower on the priority list than at least all the things that the president has already said that he wants to do since becoming president.
Any guesses? Do you think it might happen this year that a bill would come up?
Frankly, if I had to guess simply based on what I know the president's already trying to do this year, I wouldn't put too much money on it, frankly. I think that's just another issue that's going to require a lot of people, you know, being willing to bite their tongue and work together on something that, you know, has divided them on something that, you know, probably some of these individual senators themselves have said things to each other about that they wouldn't like to admit. I think that's probably going to be a heavier lift than can get done the same year that they're going to try to do health care and probably spend another $1 trillion in stimulus. If I had to guess, I would say, you know, don't hold your breath for this year, maybe next year.
Yeah, there's so much going on this year. Jim, whatever happened to that, and I can't remember his name right now, that wonderful author who wrote the terrific book on Postville, Iowa? Do you remember?
I'm drawing a blank now, too.
Yeah, it was a great book. I wonder if he's still writing books about Postville. Okay. Did you have anything else?
At the University of Iowa, Kathleen. We've actually interviewed him a few times.
Well, I'm sorry. Okay. He's at the University of Iowa?
He is. And he's still watching Postville very closely, and I'm sure he'd love to be on your show sometime.
Yeah, he was a great... That was a wonderful book. Really, really interesting. Oh, good. Thank you, Chase.
Thank you very much.
All right.
No problem.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Let's go next to... Frank is next from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hi. Interesting guests. I would ask each of them to comment on both Paul Krugman and George Stieglitz, public intellectuals and who happen to have Nobel Prizes, who think that far more activity should be directed towards a stimulus on the economy and shutting down the current rotten banking system and replacing it under supervision. Because attempting to save the institutions and the people who brought us into this situation isn't working. And the longer we wait, the greater danger we're in. The other thing is, would they comment on the Prime Minister of Britain's address to Congress? He was overly complimentary, but he was essentially saying action is needed on the financial front globally, and the United States has to lead. And he and the former Prime Minister of Canada have been urging the G20 to act immediately. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for the call. Chase.
I think that both those questions that the caller just asked get to a pretty interesting and important point, which is to say this crisis is international, and one of the pieces of the solution in the United States that a lot of economists are talking about that it seems the political figures are still unwilling to talk about publicly, even if they know privately that it's going to have to be done, is some kind of nationalization of the banks, a temporary seizure of the banks by the federal government to try to take them over, get a lot of the toxic debt off their books somehow, and then turn them back over to the private sector. That's the kind of solution that I think is what a lot of the European countries want us to do. In Europe, it would be far less unprecedented than it would be in the United States. And so I think we're going to see, because of the international scope of this crisis, that the finer points of our regulatory system in the United States are going to run right up against the finer points of the financial systems of Western Europe, of Japan and China and the rest of Asia. It's going to become strained, I think, when, the United States has an economy where that kind of move to nationalize a bank would be unheard of. But a lot of European countries, are pretty sure at this point that that's the way you solve this kind of problem. So there will be more diplomatic pressure probably from outside for the United States to adapt economic policies that, even though the Europeans know America has never really liked those policies before, the Europeans trust that they work because they've been using them. And I think the United States is going to be forced to try to experiment a little more just to appease our European allies. So I think it's going to be interesting, but the international scope of this crisis is definitely going to require the United States to rethink its economic system at least a little bit. I think in large part because, at this point, everybody in the world is in it together, and the United States is just going to have to make some concessions and do what it can to keep all of its allies on board and to keep the world economy from sinking, because, if that happens, it's even worse for everybody.
Do you feel that you know the answer, Chase, as to where the money we've already given some of those big banks has gone. We've given them a ton of money in the TARP program. Have they helped open up the economy at all, given credit, or are they sitting on the money still? And who's looking after where that money's going?
Yeah, well, I think that's the million-dollar question. And the answer is, you know, no, I won't pretend that I know exactly where that money has gone. You know, I think we know clearly that it hasn't gone to making loans, which is what it was supposed to go to. You know, a much higher percentage of the money was supposed to get loaned out by now. And that was the reason we were giving them the money in the first place. The problem is that, that no company who's, you know, that is designed purely to assess risk and determine whether it's worth taking a risk or not and what the financial value of that risk is, you know, when giving out a loan, those businesses all understand that right now is not a good time to give out a loan no matter how much capital they have. So, you know, even after getting money from the government to, you know, to be bailed out, I guess they say, they're still not loaning the money out because they know it's better to keep their powder dry, wait to see what everybody else is doing, and, you know, react from that in a couple of months. And in the meantime, the economy is getting worse.
Right. Frank, thanks so much always for your call. Jack from Eagle River. Hi, Jack.
Yes, good morning. I have two quick questions. The first one is, what percentages are we talking about as far as taxing the highest income level? It seems to me at one time it was 70%. Now it's somewhere in the 30s. And I just wonder if it's really worth even fussing about if it's a couple of percentage points. The second question has to do with the cap on Social Security. Is there any chance in the wide world of sports that they're going to play with that cap, make it infinite or make it up to 250 or whatever? Because it seems like that's the quick solution to the Social Security problem.
I think that's a good question. President Obama on the campaign trail before he got elected certainly did propose that idea of raising the cap on the Social Security and payroll taxes. And the way he discussed it was to raise the cap, but perhaps to create, I think he called it a donut hole, where, you know, if you're up against the cap right now, your income from the point where it's currently capped up to maybe 250 or 300 or whatever, $100,000, you know, that amount would not be taxed, and then on top of that amount, you would be taxed again. And it seems like President Obama did support that on the campaign trail, but hasn't talked about it much. That's probably the kind of idea that, you know, may end up being more trouble than it's worth, although it would likely solve the Social Security shortfall at least for another 10 or 15 years, I think. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like that. And on top of that, I think the other point about the raising taxes on wealthy Americans is a fair point. It is only a couple of percentage points. But at the same time, at this point, the government's running on fumes. So any amount of, you know, increase in revenue is going to make a big difference. And, you know, they're trying to keep the budget balanced on paper. So, you know, they're doing their best to get as many numbers on the positive side of their spreadsheet as they can, I guess is all I can say. But I think that is a fair point, you know, and at some point, politicians do make the political calculation, you know, is this a big enough change and an important enough policy for me to stake my entire political career on this and get a tax next election for raising taxes, which is, you know, how it works in every election, you know. So it'll become a political calculation at some point, but at this point at least, you know, I think the president's policy agenda is pretty clear. And it seems like he is interested in raising that tax.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Jack?
Yeah, there one quickie on Social Security. They were taking money from Social Security fund and dispersing it elsewhere, using it elsewhere. I haven't heard anything about that lately, and that's a big cause. Some people, that kind of upsets them to think that that money is really not there.
Yeah, well, I think there is some debate about the extent to which it was really ever there or not there. You know, there was a big hullabaloo about the state of Social Security a few years back. Both Democrats and Republicans could be accused of fear-mongering on that issue. And since then, both parties have sort of, they've stepped back a bit. It's not that Social Security is not in pretty dire straits and that it will, you know, it is at this point, you know, scheduled to run out, I don't know, in 15, 20 years, something like that. But it is not such an immediate threat that we need to start, you know, worrying too much about it. That said, that money is being spent in large part because the money that would be used to pay for Social Security isn't really even coming in through that Social Security tax anymore. Just not enough money is coming in. So how that money is being spent at this point, I'm not exactly sure, but I think that issue is still alive. It just quieted down because, you know, basically the politicians decided they had another 10 years before they had to worry about it, so they just stopped talking so loud about it. But I do think that issue is still there, and it's still a problem. It's just maybe a bit farther down the road than we once thought.
Thanks, Jack, for your call. We are doing our All Things Political, which you hear every Monday at 9 here on the Ideas Network. And our guest, Chase Martin, fairly regular guest of ours, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. Or I think you can send an email if you'd like as well, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we're going to have a good time. Our guest has written a fascinating piece in the recent issue of Metal Floss magazine, The 25 Most Influential Books of the Past 25 Years. These are books that have had an impact, whether they've saved lives or whether or not people have been killed as a result of the publication of a certain book, like Salman Rushdie's book, Predicted America's Future or Uncovered Its Past. It should be a really interesting conversation, and that's coming up, hour number two of our show. Chase Martin is here now. It's All Things Political, and we go next to Dan from Janesville. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I just wanted to ask your guest to comment on, maybe do a little analysis on the state of the Republican Party, specifically with regard to their leadership in the Congress, where you know, a guy like John Boehner, is he going to pay any kind of price for leading the party without any good results in these last couple of election cycles, and how they're caught between that and the media mouthpieces like Rush Limbaugh, who aren't really accountable to voters.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just hang up and
all right, Dan, thanks.
Thank
they are in a weird state if you consider they're having a discussion about who the leader is and whether or not it's Rush Limbaugh. He's a radio guy, right?
Sure. I was hoping we'd get a chance to talk about this for at least a minute. I do think that the Republicans find themselves in an interesting place right now. And it's a place where President Barack Obama, a Democrat, gets to have a pretty large and important voice in the discussion of who is the next leader of the Republican Party. And, you know, we at this point know that the president has cast his lot in with Rush Limbaugh, seems to want Rush Limbaugh to emerge as the leader of at least a segment of the Republican Party. It seems, you know, I know there's a fair amount of debate among Democrats about whether that's a good idea or not, whether you want to lower the presidency to the point of, you know, debating with Rush Limbaugh by name on the airwaves and from the White House press room. At the same time, it seems that the president sees that as in his advantage. If he can make the policy debate going forward over the next few months, you know, one where either you're with the president or you're with Rush Limbaugh, the congressional Republicans who have felt emboldened by all of their, you know, their ability to stall things and their ability to carve things out of the bills that the president wanted passed, you know, being able to carve out all those compromises in the stimulus bill without ultimately, you know, most of them voting for it, those sorts of things the president doesn't like, and he would prefer that those congressional Republicans, you know, don't get quite so much attention for all their opposition. He'd rather the attention went to Rush Limbaugh.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think he sees it as in his advantage. And I think he thinks some of the more reasonable Republican members of Congress, once they start to see the issue as either you're with the president or you're with Rush Limbaugh, maybe that will start to turn some of their minds.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's interesting. But the Republican Party really does find itself without one clear figurehead. The Republicans in Congress, it seems like there are maybe five or six representatives and senators who are really grappling to try to take over this the mantle of the Republican Party, and then there are maybe that many governors out in the states trying to do the same thing. But it doesn't seem like there's any united group that really, you know, there doesn't seem to be a uniting figure, I guess,
right.
I should say, around which a group could rally.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to have picked their favorite, and there seem to be people out there ready to, you know, take out or kneecap whichever this week's Republican leader is, you know, whoever the new face on the scene is, whether it's Bobby Jindal giving that speech and then getting roundly panned by, you know, a large cast of Republican operatives and other Republican insiders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like the presidential politics is already starting up, and the people who are aligned in one camp are just never going to say a nice thing about the people in the other camp,
right?
Whether it's Sarah Palin and Bobby Jindal or whoever.
Yeah.
So it's going to be hard for anybody to emerge as a strong leader because everybody has an interest in picking somebody else as the leader.
What did you think about Limbaugh's outrageous comment concerning Ted Kennedy?
Oh, you know,
I thought that was awful.
Yes, and at this point, it seems likely to me that Rush Limbaugh knew exactly what he was doing when he made
sure.
those comments.
Sure.
You know, he is at this point he is a professional rabble rouser, and he's, you know, begrudgingly, I must admit, he's good at it. And that's just his style. You know, it's the kind of thing that a fairly large percentage of Americans would find unpalatable,
mm-hmm.
And wouldn't want to listen to. But the minority of Americans who would enjoy listening to it all do listen to it. And, you know, Rush makes a good living.
Yeah, he sure does. The guy, I keep bringing up his name. Maybe because the Republicans have a slim list of who is emerging as in a leadership position. But this guy from Minnesota, Pawlenty, strikes me as somebody who could easily take over as head of the Republican Party. He's well-spoken. He's a young guy. He listens. He's not outrageous. He seems incredibly intelligent. Why aren't his stars rising? Or maybe his star is rising.
I think it's safe to say that his star is rising. That said, he comes from a state where he really has had to make compromises. I think he's the kind of candidate who does well in a state like Minnesota, and that kind of talent as a Republican can get you pretty far in a general election, you know, nationally. But at the same time, I think he's been forced to make some compromises in Minnesota. You know, for instance, he is accepting stimulus money, unlike the other Republican governors who have been talking about rejecting stimulus money recently, you know, and letting their states, you know, lose their federal money just for the point of, you know, not having as much federal control and restrictions and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He is not one of those governors. He is known for being a pretty pragmatic guy. And I think the Republican base might have trouble getting to a point where, you know, they saw him as their dream candidate simply because he really is, you know, he's. I think he would object to the characterization of himself as a Mitt Romney Republican. Maybe he's not, you know, nearly the compromiser to that extent. You know, he would never have moved health care through like Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts. But, you know, I think there are similarities to make to
mm-hmm.
draw between the two guys. And I think for that reason, Pawlenty may not be seen as pure enough to the Republican mm-hmm. base. That said, I think there's just the other reason that there isn't any one real standout thing about Pawlenty that makes you want to like him the same way that there may be about some of the other candidates,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's Bobby Jindal with the life story and, you know, very specific examples of what Jindal has done in the wake of Katrina, you know, when he came to power a year or so later, that sort of thing, or whether it's Sarah Palin who has, you know, just her charisma and her personality, and at this point the brand she has built for herself, you know, is a force to be reckoned with. Pawlenty just doesn't have that kind of thing going for him. So perhaps in a race in a crowded field for president in 2012, Pawlenty may just be one of those candidates that, you know, everybody agrees is qualified, everybody likes, but there's nothing about that candidate that makes people want to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost a Chris Dodd or Joe Biden mm. type figure
mm-hmm.
From the Democratic field in 08.
Interesting. Thanks, Dan, for your call. Babs is next from Stevens Point. Hi, Babs. Hello,
Hi.
Are you there?
Let me think. Everything I read says that this could possibly be $175 trillion worth of toxic paper out there generated by our banks throughout the globe. If that's the case, I mean, and there are different figures, but the top one was $175 trillion. So far as I understand, we have given the banks $9 trillion, okay? And nobody is buying our debt anymore. We are being forced to start printing our own money and buying our own treasury bills and so on and so forth, which will mean hyperinflation. So, and our GDP is just $13 trillion. So what is the reason to continue the bailout when there's no hope of really bailing it out? Is it simply a transfer of wealth? And what will be left for the people of this country when it does finally come down, because there will be nothing left?
Well, that's a scary question. if you don't mind me being humorous about it for a minute, because that's one of the ways I deal with it. If those numbers are correct, and some of them sounded right to me, others sounded maybe a bit high, as you admitted. Then, I think it's a fair point to ask: can the government ever spend enough money to get us out of this problem? If we're really talking about $175 trillion of toxic debt, frankly, I don't have the answer to that question. I think there's a feeling among the government and on Wall Street that the appearance of doing something, even though it hasn't helped the stock market much, at least that was thought to be an important factor in, getting the stock market more stable and start moving it back up again, is make the government look like it's doing something, and Americans will start to think, hey, maybe this will get better. But that said, looking like you're doing something is certainly not the only thing that's important, and if it's not going to get anything fixed, then, I don't know. But frankly, yeah, the situation you described does sound hopeless. And I hope that the two of us don't understand it well enough, and that somebody out there understands it better and doesn't think it's so hopeless.
I'm with you on that.
Sorry, I don't have a better answer.
Thanks, Babs, so much for your call. Lynn from Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I'm kind of backstepping a couple of phone calls, and this one has to do with the wealthy and paying their income taxes, and you had said you thought it was just a couple of points. There was a multimillionaire, and I cannot remember his name, and I know that's important, but he was saying because the loopholes in the taxes, he ends up paying 17% in income taxes, while his secretary pays 27%. I think if there was a fairness in the tax structure and the 1% or the 2% of the wealth starts paying their equal share like the rest of us, it would generate a lot of money.
Yeah, do we know how much money? Has that been floating around, Chase?
There is a number that has gotten thrown around a fair amount, the original size of the Bush tax cuts. Let me see if I can. I doubt I'll be able to look it up. We are not talking about... I'm trying to think. Yeah, frankly, Kathleen, I don't want to throw something out there that I don't know.
Right. It's a substantial amount.
Yes, it is a substantial amount, but it is not, for instance, substantial in the context of, a lot of things the government spends money on.
Right.
So, these numbers in the federal budget just operate on an order of magnitude that's, beyond my mathematical comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
But we are talking about significant amounts of money, definitely.
And when she talks about these loopholes, is it a part of, I don't know, the budget bill or one of those many bills out there that would closely examine these loopholes and close some of them down?
Yeah, that's a movement that has been taking shape for years now. There are some who argue that the solution is simplifying the tax code. There are others who argue that the solution is just getting rid of loopholes, as they say. Unfortunately, you call something a loophole, and that means one thing. but one person's loophole is another person's business incentive or another person's development tax credit. And rolling those types of quote-unquote loopholes back, you know, isn't universally seen as a positive thing. Some of these loopholes are really, you know, useful to some people, and they incentivize important behavior. So, you know, maybe they're important to keep. So from what I've been told, that issue is far less black and white than it seems when we talk about it simply in terms of loopholes, because, you know, nobody intends to write a loophole into a law. They just write something that they do think is worthy into the law, and it becomes a loophole.
Chase, thanks. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much. I had a great time.
So did I. Chase Martin, we wish the news were a little better, who's managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll return following the latest news here on the Ideas Network.